This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Our society, culture, and economy centers on one material object, the car. It has represented our identity, freedom, independence, and wealth. But what happens when that object of our collective obsession becomes something else? The cars, trucks, and limos become autonomous vehicles. They are smart and clean. We become a nation of passengers. But what about the driverless divide? Who benefits from this road revolution that will change everything? What happens to the truck drivers, taxi and rideshare drivers? How does driverless cars also mean fewer transplant organs? Are you ready to say, Elon, take the wheel, bring on the driverless cars? There's lots of ways for you to get into our conversation as we talk about the future. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. You can email questions and comments to The Source at tpr.org and tweet at us at tprsource. We're joined this afternoon by Samuel Schwartz. He's the author of No One at the Wheel, Driverless Cars, and the Road on the Future. And Sam, welcome to The Source.
Thank you very much.
So a lot of people, they haven't seen the memo. They don't know what's happening. When are these cars coming?
Well, they're already here to some extent. They're in limited test areas or what's called geofenced areas, meaning under certain controlled circumstances. But Waymo is operating in Arizona. Uber has been doing some autonomous vehicles, although they have a driver there just in case, in Pittsburgh and San Francisco. They're around, and to some extent they've been around for a number of years now. Some cities in England have been using them, but moving at a very, very slow pace. They're not doing what drivers normally do, and that is drive quite swiftly on streets and highways.
Moving at a slow pace, depends on how you look at it. You know, the adoption of technology, when you look at how soon we how long it took us to get from horse-drawn carriages to a full automobile fleet society, that took a while. It didn't happen overnight. Compared to that, I mean, it could be like you turn around and they're here.
Yeah, well, remember, a lot of people already own cars. They're not about to trade them in by 2020 for a new AV. But gradually, you will see autonomous vehicles making it into the 2020s. Still, the majority will be what I call partially autonomous, having autonomous features, meaning you may have lane control on it, crash avoidance technology, but not fully driverless. So we'll have a decade, the 2020s, in which we have some autonomous vehicles, not too many out there, but by the 2030s, we'll see plenty, and by mid-century, it will be the majority of vehicles.
We got an email from one of our listeners. He says, speaking as a scientist, I see no way self-driving cars and trucks can ever work. Most scientists and engineers know this, but will never say this because research into self-driving cars and trucks is a cash cow. So that's from Blaine Russell. What do you say to Blaine?
Yeah, I'd say he's onto something. There is a lot of hype about autonomous vehicles and how they could solve just about every problem. But many engineers and scientists, as he points out, know a couple of little things, such as they haven't yet to be able to figure out what a pedestrian does or a bicycle rider. So while they do work quite well, and I know you mentioned truckers in the very beginning, on long-haul truck routes, highways, when you get into the center of cities, if you're in downtown San Antonio or anywhere where there are pedestrians and maybe bike riders, and now we've got scooters and other things, it's going to be a while before they could figure that out unless we allow the industry to do something the car industry did many, many years ago, and that is criminalize or some of the activity that we do now in walking, or put up fences and not let us walk in the streets and have cattle chutes at intersections.
So you're talking about there was an era when the streets belonged to pedestrians. Before they were handed over to cars, pedestrians were just walking all over the place. And the whole idea of who owns the streets was something that was fought over. And now we're going to have that fight again?
Yeah, bloody battles 100 years ago or so. Pedestrians for hundreds of thousands of years walked in the direct path. All of a sudden, they were being told that if we shine a light in your face, a red light, you have to stop, a green light, you can go. When you walk, you don't walk in a straight line. You walk in right angles. You walk, hug buildings and then cross at intersections. And that was a battle that was bitterly fought. It was a bloody, bloody battle with loads of children who were playing in the streets. People used the streets as their path. And then suddenly the cars started to come in, and there were many fatalities. The bloodiest period in America was really 1910 to 1930. And ultimately the cars won, and pedestrian behavior was criminalized. I'm afraid we're entering a period like that. There are lots of good things that driverless cars could do. It helps people with disabilities. It helps perhaps the elderly and others get around. There's some greater efficiency. But we should plan for it. We shouldn't let it happen and let the industry dictate how our streets are to be used.
So I think that goes to the title of your book, No One at the Wheel. Who is in the driver's seat when it comes to making the policy decisions about driverless cars? Are we just going to hand this over to industry leaders and they're going to make these decisions? Will this be on a local level, state level, national level? And this is also something that's going to be impacting the entire world. And we have to do an evaluation of the benefits. You know, if this does mean clean transportation, that's not nothing. So is that the main point?
Yeah, that's one of the points, and that's why I use the term no one, instilled no one is at the wheel. The federal government in October released something called Autonomous Vehicles 3.0, and essentially what it says is let the industry proceed. Let's not handcuff the industry in any way. And it seemed like, laissez-faire, and the industry will dictate the terms. I've noticed a number of states are now passing regulations so that local cities and towns won't be able to abridge, and I put this in quote, the rights of autonomous vehicles. So I'm pretty worried because I think there's a huge lobbying effort that's going on right now. It's below the radar. When you look at 6 years ago, 7 years ago, when Uber launched its lobbying effort, they were unbelievably successful getting pro-Uber regulations in all 50 states. Whether these were blue states or purple states or red states, that is very effective. I'm afraid the same thing is happening with autonomous vehicles.
And the policy changes that they dream about would be what? Banning people who drive themselves, banning of motorcycles, banning of pedestrians that would get in the way of their driverless vehicles.
Yeah, that's one of my fears now.
I tell you what, we're going to take a break right here. We're going to get more into that when we come back. Do people have a right to drive themselves? We'll talk about that and other issues, questions that are coming up. If we don't talk about this now, these questions will be settled even before many of us know that they were questions. The number to call in is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. What are your questions and comments about a future of driverless cars and your rights on the road? This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. You might remember that movie, Arnold Schwarzenegger movie, Total Recall, where he is getting a taxi. It's a self-driving car. And if you know Mexico City, you recognize that spot where they shot that. It's the Insurgentes metro station. But the driver, it's a driverless vehicle. Takes the protagonist around as he runs from the bad guys. Is that the future? Will we have driverless vehicles just like that? We're talking about that with Samuel Schwartz. He's the author of No One at the Wheel, Driverless Cars and the Road of the Future. Sam was also the transportation commissioner, the New York City traffic commissioner, and he was also with the New York City Department of Transportation chief engineer. So, Sam, will people have a right to drive, or will that just be taken away and either it's my way or the highway with a self-driving car?
To the federal government in that document, AV 3.0, did say one of the rights is for Americans to drive. I don't see it happening in the United States. I do see it happening around the world, that the safety statistics will be so good ultimately by mid-century that people will be prohibited from driving. It's less likely to happen in the United States. Driving, you know, having a car is kind of like having our horse. It's one of our rights. And I don't think that will happen.
The number to call in if you've got a question or comment is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. One of our rights is freedom to assembly, and that could be seen as the ability to drive. Is that, you know, would you see that as the foundation of a right to drive?
Yes. In fact, the federal government does use the word freedom. We enjoy our freedoms. I don't have the exact word, but they do use that term. There's already groups that are forming of drivers that have kind of gotten wind of this, that they may lose their rights. And so organizations are now fighting to make sure that driving is allowed going forward.
Well, they can't outright ban people from driving on the road, but they could make it in such a way that the economics of it would be prohibited. Suddenly your insurance is going to be out of control. Because if you are the person who is causing the possibility of so much damage, but the driverless cars, their insurance is practically nil because the way that they're able to drive.
That's right. So there may be a number of handicaps that a conventional driver would have. Certainly one is insurance. Individually owned cars may also face some kind of extra fees because there is a real intention in the future to go to fewer cars being owned but more cars being used as ride services. Many of the car companies, are their long-term plans are to go from selling cars to selling rides. And then there are a lot of cities that are and even on highways that are going to decide this lane will move a lot better if it only has autonomous vehicles. So while I think your right to drive will always be there, it will be quite limited and may be very expensive.
You say that we're in a fork in the road with these driverless cars. One of them is we predict a utopia where we have these beautiful, clean cars and they pick you up and it's just wonderful. And the other one is this dystopia where it's not so nice. What's the dystopian view?
So the dystopian view is we don't change our behavior very much. We have individual ownership of cars, and soon those cars are not just driving us to work, but then they're driving alone back home, waiting to get the call. We begin, and that adds miles traveled, adds traffic. We encourage sprawl and live even further out. And that adds traffic. We buy into the concept that we don't need public transportation because cars can move so closely together. The reality is they can never mimic the capacity of public transportation. All those things together mean worsening traffic congestion, perhaps doubling the miles traveled. Perhaps that then increases the number of crashes, which we had hoped to be decrease, and maybe it makes us more sedentary, which has become an epidemic in the United States now. In the past 25 years, we've seen a huge increase in inactivity diseases, and obesity.
How are we able to avoid these things? Let me go over some of these items that you brought up. So, example, this urban sprawl. So suddenly, if I have an hour-long commute or a 90-minute commute, even longer, I can use that time now to watch TV or to read or to work on the computer on the internet and not worry about driving. And suddenly I can move further out from the inner city and into that becomes a possibility, right?
That's right. And when you're moving out, and if you look at definitions in the U.S., what was a rural area is now often called a suburban area. And this means loss of more and more rural areas, of low density areas, probably of very protected areas. And it also means more driving, more miles on the road, more infrastructure that's needed for those people as more and more people live further out.
And for congestion, say I take my my self-driving vehicle to run an errand, go to downtown to go to a doctor's office or something, and while I'm inside, I don't park my vehicle. It just circles around the block until I finally until I come out. And so don't worry about parking. The car is just basically in motion, taking up space that should be left for point-to-point transportation.
That's right. And you might even send the call home and say, I'm going to be about an hour. Your home is just 10 minutes away. So it's, you know, 5 or 10 miles away. So that's an extra 5 or 10 miles each way. So you've doubled your mileage. And we're going to see a lot of that if we have individual ownership. Even with Uber and Lyft, the Uber drivers right now, to move a passenger 1 mile, the Uber vehicle moves 1.6 miles. That's a 60% increase in traffic. That has led to enormous traffic congestion problems in many of the large cities that now have quite a few Ubers and Lyfts and other forms of app-based transportation. So traffic congestion will get worse. And then inactivity, the example you gave, just even imagine going to a shopping center and instead of you parking and walking 500 feet to the front of the door, you get dropped off at the front of the door. Your car does 500 feet of so-called walking. We become kind of like a scene out of WALL-E in which our chairs become autonomous and we no longer have need for use of our legs. And that's why I think inactivity diseases could very well soar. They're already epidemic in the world, epidemic in the United States. And in the past year, they've exceeded the number of deaths of smoking. So it's the number one killer in the world right now.
Let's go to the phone lines, 210-614-8980. Matthew has called in. Hey, Matthew, thanks for calling in. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call. I'm an Uber driver and a Lyft driver in San Antonio with over 6,000 rides completed. I just wanted to say that a lot of the time when you're picking somebody up as a rideshare driver, they're not where you think they are. And it's essential for you to call them on the phone and communicate with them human to human in order to know exactly where they are. And so I think that for a driverless rideshare system to be successful, the navigation has to be substantially improved. Otherwise, the cars are not going to connect with the people.
So, Matthew, are you concerned about being replaced by a robot car?
No, not really. Not to be honest with you. I mean, in order to be replaced by a robot car, I mean, that car has to be owned by somebody. It's not going to be owned by a rideshare company. They're not in the business of owning fleets of vehicles that they have to maintain and pay insurance on.
All right, Matthew, thank you for the call. So back to Sam Schwartz, author of the book No One at the Wheel, to Matthew's point about how these cars are not going to be able to do what he does.
Yeah. Location is going to be tough, but people will have devices so it could get even more precise, and there are ways of communicating with vehicles. But Matthew was incorrect when he talked about the companies themselves. The companies are looking to own fleets of vehicles. Right now, the model is individually owned Ubers, but in the future, absolutely, it will be fleet-owned. These will be autonomous vehicles, and they will probably be electric vehicles. There's so many cost savings that could go into this for these rideshare services that just about every car company is now looking at merging with rideshare companies or doing it themselves.
Now to Claiborne. And Claiborne, thanks for calling in. You're on the air.
Hi. I was wondering if you all could address three areas of failure mode. The first being, how often does your iPhone or your computer or the radio station's transmitter or feed have a failure? The second is, how often is GPS incorrect or TxDOT changes the road? And then there's, like, between here and Port Aransas or between here and Alabama on 10, little or no signal and no data.
What was that last point again, Claiborne? On I-10?
No data and no signal.
Okay, so if I'm doing, like, a cross-country road trip and we'd get out of signal range. Thank you so much for those calls. So, Mr. Schwartz, what do you think?
Yeah, he's right. You know, the industry, again, is hyping safety, but what we have seen so far, even from the best or the most advanced manufacturers, there is a disengagement, meaning there's someone sitting there watching the vehicle drive, but there's a disengagement on average of 2,000 to 3,000 miles. Now, that means that the car had to be taken over by a driver. So there are times that it fails today. It fails way too often. The crash rate of the vehicles in autonomous mode right now, there isn't any good data except from the state of California. And in California, the crash rate for these vehicles is about 9 times higher than the conventional driver. There's another point that the listener brought up that I want to mention, and that is the infrastructure isn't quite there. So the AV industry wants to rely on us, the public, to provide really good infrastructure, communications, infrastructure, but also good lane lines, good road surfaces, good signs, good traffic signals, and others. One thing I point out in my book, who's going to pay for this? And this is an opportunity where we have a nascent industry. Let's charge the autonomous vehicles 10 cents a mile, and ultimately we will see our roads, our bridges maintained in beautiful conditions, because we'll have more money than we've ever had before.
Because right now, the money for road maintenance typically comes from gas tax. We're using, not as much gas as we used to. Cars are getting better. If we go to completely electric vehicles, where's that? No one's going to be using any gas. We got to figure out another way, another model to pay for that.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, we haven't raised the gas tax federally since 1993, it was. Maybe even earlier than that. It might have been in the 1980s. And we have seen a dwindling because cars have become efficient. So it's the public, the general public, whether they're using the roads or not, that's picking up the cost of maintaining it. And because there hasn't been enough money, we see our infrastructure regularly from the Society of Civil Engineers, which I belong to, gets a rating of about a D. Now, the autonomous industry is going to need really good roads, good bridges, good communication systems, and I don't think the public should be paying for it. I think we should let that industry contribute to that maintenance.
But then there's all these benefits that come from having these autonomous vehicles, safer streets and being able to move around, transportation for people who are right now can't drive. So there's upsides.
Oh, absolutely. And by the way, many of the safety features autonomous vehicles would be relying on are available now for people that could afford it. Front-end crash avoidance systems, blind spot monitoring, lane controls. So we could achieve a lot of the safety without autonomous vehicles. But no doubt when you take the driver out of the equation, you'll see even fewer crashes. That's a great benefit. We have a great benefit in terms of people with disabilities, but the same could be said about public transportation. Public transportation
right.
is already 95% safer than driving.
Okay.
Yet we don't subsidize public transportation to the same extent.
Taking a break, the number to call in is 210-614-8980, the road to driverless cars. Stay tuned. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Are you ready for the world of driverless cars? This reality is just around the corner. It's coming faster than you might think. Will this be a world of a utopia where these smart cars are solving so many of our problems? We got clean fuel cars, no more congestion, safer streets. Or will this not be that way? Just the opposite. Will we have more congestion? Less safe streets. You'll be banned from driving on the road. It'll just infringe upon your privacy and your rights. Who's going to be making these policy decisions as we get ourselves towards this future? Who is going to be in the driver's seat as we talk about driverless cars? We're talking to Samuel Schwartz. He's the author of the book, No One at the Wheel, Driverless Cars and the Future and the Road of the Future. And you can call in with your questions and comments, 210-614-8980. What does this mean for public transportation? What about motorcycles? Will they be banned from the road? Would you be willing to buy a driverless car, or would you want to subscribe to some sort of service like you do for your phone? You know, and you get X number of data bandwidth things, and maybe you get X number of miles that you'd be able to get with a driverless car that you subscribe to. 210-614-8980. And Chris is on the line. Chris, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. Me and my friend were discussing some of the fallout. We're talking about electric cars, and he's in the solar industry, and so he's all about, you know, electric vehicles and electric everything. And we started talking about some of the economic fallout for municipalities, especially in smaller towns where, you know, in Texas we've got these big roads and you go through these little speed traps where, you know, it goes from 65 to 40 and there's a cop right behind that 40-mile-an-hour to pop you with a $200 ticket. And a lot of these small towns especially really rely on income from tickets and whatnot. And so we were discussing the kind of economic fallout from the electric vehicle, or the driverless vehicle, and electric, of course, but from tickets to insurance to parking spaces. I know the city owns a lot of parking garages here in town, and other cities do as well. But aside from just the initial impact of, you know, of gas taxes and everything else, there's a huge economic impact in my mind, you know, from kind of the extraneous pieces of a driverless world.
Chris, thanks for that call. And so, Sam Schwartz.
Yeah, Chris hit upon a number of things that a lot of people haven't thought about, but a lot of localities, towns, and even cities rely very much on revenue from driving. And it could be when cars are parked and they're getting revenue from the parked vehicles. It could be when the cars are getting tickets and speeding. There's a lot of revenue that is going to be lost. The parking industry is already taking a pretty big hit in larger cities, at airports and other places, from Uber and Lyft, because people aren't driving their own cars. They're not even renting cars at these places in the same numbers as before. So the parking industry, in my estimation, over the next 30 years, as we go from few driverless to almost all driverless, the parking industry is going to take a 50 to 70% hit in the number of spaces that will be needed in this country. Insurance is another one. While there should be fewer crashes in the beginning, there are going to be more crashes, I predict, as we have a mix of vehicles that are out there. But ultimately, you will have fleets of vehicles out there. You will have negotiated insurance for the fleets. And those people trying to get individual insurance will find it tougher and more expensive.
And so with the parking spaces, you know, so much real estate is taken up with places to park your vehicle, because you only use your vehicle 20% of the time, if that, and the rest of the time it sits in a parking spot. If you don't have to have all that parking, then all this property becomes available, particularly in prime areas, in urban centers. What does that mean?
Yeah, no, it's a good point. And on average in the United States, the car is used 5% of the time. So 95% of the time it's idle and it is parked. But in the future, especially if it's the fleet model that I'm talking about, you don't need very much parking. It's a great opportunity for cities and towns that have devoted a lot of land to parking as the years go on and you need fewer and fewer spaces. And already a number of cities are seeing that. It's an opportunity to convert that into something else. It could be housing, it could be parkland, it could be schools. What I advise clients in my business right now, if they need to build a garage, make it convertible. And what that means is flat floors, not sloping floors, put the ramps on the outside, high enough ceilings, and then someday when you don't need the garage anymore, it could be converted to a building.
You talk about it in a book, you mentioned it, the Pensacola problem.
Sure. You know, what we do is we provide parking for everything, and you'll see parking lot after building, and we provide parking when where we live, where we work, where we visit, and ultimately we become a land of parking.
So you knock down all the interesting buildings in order to put up parking lots, and so then there's nothing to go to anymore.
That's right. And you take a look, even not just Pensacola, but if you take a look at some of our cities, when I traveled to some of the big cities, I remember being in Atlanta downtown and it's beginning to change, but it was building parking lot, then building then parking lot or garage. And that doesn't result in a lively urban environment or for a town, a nice walking environment. It creates these kinds of breaks, and it also means people never use the streets.
Let's go to the caller. This is Jeff. Hi, Jeff. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Part of my question kind of piggybacks on the last caller, but I was just wondering about in the situation with like parking traffic violations or maybe a fender bender, where does the liability lay when there's no driver at the wheel? And, or in a situation where, let's say, a driverless car commits a traffic violation and a policeman tries to pull it over, like what would the protocols be there even?
Jeff, thanks for the call.
Yeah. Now, Jeff, this happened about a week and a half ago. A Tesla was driving in driverless mode. The driver was asleep. I believe he was intoxicated, or at least that's what's alleged. The police were notified that there was a driver asleep at a wheel moving on a highway at 70 miles an hour. It took them about 7 miles to finally slow the vehicle down and stop it, and then arrest the driver. For law enforcement, it's going to be quite difficult to stop an autonomous vehicle. One of the things that I call for are protocols, so all the vehicles react appropriately towards law enforcement and can stop. And in those events, if there is a crash between two vehicles, that's going to be, who's at fault right now. As I mentioned, the vehicles in autonomous mode are getting into crashes more often than other vehicles, and the liability almost every time when I read the crash reports is assigned to the other driver and not to the autonomous or the vehicle in autonomous mode. So the legalities of this are a real challenge going forward.
What about the high-speed chase? Is that going to go away?
Yeah. One thing also that I call for is the protocols, so that a vehicle cannot go 110 miles an hour, 150 miles an hour, or when it hits an urban area, go faster than, say, 30 miles an hour or so. If we don't have that kind of agreement between the private sector and government, we run the risk of the police not having a vehicle that can match up with a souped-up autonomous vehicle that now knows each of the routes where all the vehicles are on the road and had a snake around all of them. It's going to be a heyday for the bad guys, but on the other hand, we'll have more intelligence as to where that car is going.
Will the police be in self-driving patrol cars?
I think it's going to be a while before we see that, but by mid-century, yes, police will be in driverless cars. I'm sure there's going to be some police vehicles that are not driverless. Because one of the things that I call for is that the driverless vehicle must obey the rules and regulations. Again, that's in my good scenario, in my utopia. And in that scenario, the police may at sometimes have to violate speed limits, directional controls, go through traffic signals, and an autonomous vehicle will be programmed otherwise.
Why not give the police officer a kill switch for cars that they can identify?
Yeah. One of my worries is the hackers will also do those kinds of switches. And there is a whole counterterrorism concern right now. And the counterterrorism community has been able to hack into vehicles, and so has the industry. And, sadly, we have seen a rise in cars used as weapons. We had that in New York City a little more than a year ago. We had that in Barcelona, in Nice, in Berlin, and a number of other locations. So there's a fear in the counterterrorism industry that that cars will be controlled from 3,000 miles away, and you may have 10 cars being controlled simultaneously. So that's why I'm not, calling for kill switches to be that available.
Or you could be kidnapped in your own vehicle. Someone could just, lock the doors and drive you to another location that you didn't want to go to, and suddenly you're a captive.
Yes, plenty of stuff for Hollywood movies to consider.
Right. So, I mean, why are we having all these thought games here about all this? Is because we have to think about the future. What are the possibilities? What are the vulnerabilities? Come up with solutions now. Particularly, how will this impact our economy? How will this impact the availability? I mean, how do we make sure that this is there's a level of equality and availability for everyone to get hold of this technology? If you got a question or a comment, it's 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. We're speaking with Samuel Schwartz. He's the author of the book, No One at the Wheel, Driverless Cars and the Road of the Future. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the possible futures that we're going to be heading towards with these driverless cars. And the number to call in is 210-614-8980. And Barbara is on the line. Barbara, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Okay, thank you. I would like Mr. Schwartz to comment on using a connected system of light rail, streetcars, bus rapid transit, bus, bike, walking paths, etc. All of that, if you had all of that working in San Antonio, you have an efficient system going into the future, because light rail, streetcars, all those things will run on solar and wind in the future. All of that brings on a sense of community, people out exercising. You get more exercise, you become less sedentary. The roads are less congested because you're taking because light rail has a lot of capacity. Like one light rail vehicle with one light rail vehicle on a train, it has two times the capacity of a bus. So it's like a four-car bus is the equivalent of eight. A four-car light rail is the equivalent of eight buses.
Okay, Barbara, so, thank you for the I think at your point there. And so a lot of cities have invested in light rail, and this is something that they have sold bonds on. This is going to cost them for a long time to pay off. And will people still be hopping on the light rail if there's a driverless car at their beck and call?
Yeah, Barbara described what I would call more in the utopia version, which is what I'm hoping for. If local governments still have a say, I would advise local governments to continue to promote good public transportation, because you'll never get that kind of efficiency out of autonomous vehicles. And Barbara also brought up the sense of community and health benefits from it. But if we buy into this hype, which is an untruth, that autonomous vehicles operating very closely together could be as efficient as a good bus line or a good light rail line, not even close. And so I encourage cities to continue investing in good public transportation. The autonomous vehicles, the direction that I'd like to see is that the autonomous vehicles are mostly public transportation vehicles, what I call microtransit, smaller vehicles. Especially in lower density areas, you can run triple the number of buses that you're running right now more efficiently at the same cost. You can know where passengers are and when the passengers are there, and you get them to their destinations much faster. Also, the integration of these microtransit vehicles, or AVs, with what is called last mile to transit facilities, those people for whom transit doesn't make sense today, an AV could take them to a train station or a bus station and doesn't need a parking spot.
Now, we're talking about public roads, and so the public needs to be involved in making decisions about what kind of vehicles are going to be allowed on these roads, right?
Yes, and the public is going to have great expenditures. Barbara also used the term.
Say again? Barbara used the term
what? Okay. What the end is, she used the term connected vehicles, and the vehicles will not only be connected to each other, they'll be able to communicate, but they'll be communicating with the infrastructure. So this is another burden in which the AV industry wants and should have smart infrastructure, but I'd like them to contribute to that.
So we have to think about the dominating force that we have in America, and that is capitalism. We have people who see a lot of dollar signs with this coming technical revolution, just as we did with the burst of the bursting forth of the personal computer. There was a lot of wealth that was generated at that time, and then there was a crash. What would that look like with these driverless cars? Suddenly, these things become a reality. I know you expressed some skepticism about that, but if they get all those kinks worked out, and boom, they say, I'm hearing 2021 that we're going to be seeing some big developments, some things put on the market. If this happens, people are going to think, wow, let's make a lot of money off of this.
Oh, boy, they're already thinking that. This is an industry. Intel has estimated the value of this industry by mid-century at $7 trillion. I've heard $10 trillion. Waymo, which is one of the leaders in autonomous vehicles, one of the valuations I read, and at the time they hadn't sold anything, was $175 billion. Valuation here will probably be 10 times the value of the top 10 car companies in the world today. There's so much money here to be made. There's so many companies investing, and yeah, a number of them are going to crash, and we may have vehicles that are out there that we can't communicate with.
But are they looking at how they can, of course they're looking at this, how can we make the most amount of money with the least amount of investment? And rather than, do they think they can make more money not by selling cars, but by making us be subscribers to the vehicles?
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, the model that I would say most companies are leaning towards, at least publicly what they're saying, is fleet-owned, selling rides as opposed to selling cars. But when I look at some of the material that's being put out, Volvo, for example, just put out a YouTube video of their car of the future. You wake up in the morning and, you know, your coffee is being brewed in your car. You then do your work in your car. Later on, you have a romantic dinner in your car. And then in the evening, you go to sleep in your car. So that lends itself to the individually owned model. And if we go that way, it will be transportation for the wealthy. People will buy these cars, at, you know, and in the beginning at $100,000 a pop or more. But the costs will go down as they've gone with cell phones and computers. Essentially, an autonomous vehicle is a cell phone on wheels.
And we saw a very quick adoption of cell phone technology in America. It took about 10 years, and pretty much everyone had one. And you think you're talking about how long it takes to turn over the fleet of vehicles that we have on the streets now, but that's under typical circumstances. If there are economic drivers, and if the government and all sorts of people are out there pushing for this, this could happen probably in about that same time, about 10 years.
Yeah, I don't see it happening that fast, but it could. There are some people that are estimating by 2030, we're going to see the vast majority of our travel will be in autonomous mode. I think it's going to be a fraction of that. But nonetheless, it's how much resources, if the public government signals green lights that you can use every single road in the United States and nobody shall abridge your freedom. And by the way, the federal government is authorizing vehicles without meeting safety requirements to be using the roads in autonomous mode. So if we see more and more of that, yes, we could see a push towards selling many more of these vehicles. The costs could drop down and it will be a shock to the system. And we may not cope in the best way.
What about personal privacy? Will they're going to be able to track everywhere that I go, also probably every conversation that I have inside the vehicle, and maybe even video of me inside the vehicle? All that's going to be cached somewhere?
Yeah. So harvesting that data, marketing that data, monetizing that data is a big part of autonomous vehicles. So you will, as you're watching your screen, a pop-up will come by of a nearby store that you can easily, you know, divert to, or some other things that you need at home. They're going to know everything about you. Well, by the way, I'd say a lot of stuff is known about us already, but the kinds of things that, we've been seeing, they'll be greater. They'll know how you're moving, when you're moving, what perhaps what you're saying, as you point out. I believe a lot of these vehicles will have cameras on them. So while the private ones may not have that, I think the fleet vehicles will have cameras. So our privacy, pretty much gone.
So we've been weighing this utopia world versus this dystopia world of driverless cars. What is your personal view? What do you think we're going to end up with?
I'm pretty frightened. I would say if history bears out, it's going to be more the dystopia. We're going to learn the hard way, and then we're going to try to correct things. But I'm going to be pushing as hard as I can, and there are others, not just myself. But it's going to be really tough because we're up against unbelievable power and money.
I teased this at the beginning. I didn't get the answer. So how will driverless cars lead to fewer donated organs?
If indeed they lead to fewer crashes, there are going to be fewer dead bodies to harvest organs from.
That could be a good thing, though.
It's both a good, fewer people are dying, but maybe more people are dying from inactivity, and they will have diseased organs. So the availability of getting an organ will likely go down.
So that pretty much sums up, the complicated future that we're facing here. Neither good nor bad, or a mix of so many things, depending on how you use this technology.
Exactly. And my first title for the book was Driverless Cars, the Good, the Bad, and the Ugly.
Okay. All right. I want to thank our guest, Samuel Schwartz. He is the author of No One at the Wheel, Driverless Cars and the Road of the Future. He is the former New York City Traffic Commissioner, and he was with the New York City Department of Transportation's chief engineer. And I want to thank you so much for joining us.
You're quite welcome.
And this is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks so much for tuning us in.